Right, it says here it's time to start, so we better start. Good afternoon, everyone. Second week, Informatics One, Cognitive Science. I'm still Henry Thompson. You're still the students. Moving on to vision. Remember I said we're going to have two themes running in alternate weeks, language theme last week, vision, memory, and attention theme this week, and so on. And this is the first of the lectures and the first of the weeks for vision, memory, and attention, and we're going to look at vision. Thinking about it, and we've been talking about computer analogy, right? Using the analogy of computation, the metaphor of the computer as a way of understanding what's going on. So an obvious thing to do is to use the computer as the metaphor, right? And so we think of the optic tectum, that's the region of the brain that the optic nerve connects to, as a display. And the optic nerve maps light coming in through the retina, through the lens, onto the retina, through the optic nerve, paints a nice picture on the optic tectum that moves the image from the outside world into the brain. Cool. Looks like that, right? Nice idea. Sort of feels like the right sort of thing to do. There's a bug, isn't there? Right? There's what's called a homunculus hiding in this idea, a little human being. Because somebody has to be looking at that giraffe inside the head. If it's a display that's projecting an image, as it were, on a screen, as it were, in the brain somewhere, then, well, what's looking at the screen? And there are lots of wonderful pictures around that attempt to illustrate this. This is one that I grabbed from Wikipedia. We have a pointer, maybe. Yes, right? So we have this guy, and he's looking at, somewhat bizarrely, what appears to be a fried egg on a dish in front of a computer. Why he's trying to feed a fried egg to his computer is not clear, but I don't understand that part of the picture either. Anyway, he's looking at a fried egg, and we've got this sometimes called a theater in the mind, in which the image has been projected on the screen, and the sounds that are coming in from outside have been piped in through the speakers. But then there's somebody sitting here looking at the picture. That's the bug, because after all, what's he looking at the picture with? Well, he's looking at the picture with his eyes, right? And so we get this that we haven't actually changed the problem, we've just shrunken it, right? And so there's an infinite regress, right? He's got to be looking at the picture, so he's got to have, and so on. We haven't explained anything. So whatever else the story is about how the whole vision system works, it's not that simple an analogy. It's not like that. Right? We've got to get a little more detail in there. We've got to get some more structure in there. It can't be like this at all. We have to not only project or couple parts of the brain to the outside world via the optic nerve and all the rest of that, but we have to transform them into something other than just a literal reproduction of the externality in the brain. And it will take us several weeks before we begin to feel like we've gotten there. But we'll lay the groundwork today. So, bottom line, what we're claiming is the eye and the optic system as a whole are not just a camera, digital or otherwise, right? There are some superficial similarities. I don't intend you to be able to see the details of this picture, but we have an external image being projected through a lens onto a screen. That's all true, right? And if we had a digital camera or an old-fashioned camera, we have an image being projected through a lens onto a screen, and there's also the viewfinder involved and the mirror flips out of the way and the light goes onto the screen, and either you get a digital image or you get an old-fashioned analog image, as the case may be, right? So there are some analogies, right? They both come through small apertures. They focus on items at different distances by changing the focal length of the system as a whole. They bend the incoming light and indeed flip it up for down. There's some light-sensitive surface, either it's the retina or it's the film or it's the charge-coupled device in a digital camera. But that's about it, right? After that, the similarities sort of end. The camera is passive. Vision involves many, many layers of active interpretation and processing, as we'll see as we go along. Although our experience of the visual field feels very direct and very immediate, and when things change, it feels like they change. My perception of them changes right away. But it's actually, little light fingered on the fingers there. It's actually the end result of a lot of processing behind the scenes. And our sense of immediacy is actually delayed by that processing. So what we think we're seeing right now actually happened 200 or 300 milliseconds ago, and so on. And I could keep saying that indefinitely, fill the entire lecture by saying, what you're seeing right now actually happened 200 or 300, what you're seeing right now, right, like that. So what we're going to try to do over the next couple of weeks is simultaneously, sort of flipping back and forth, introduce more detail about what we understand about the bio neurophysiological realities up here, you know, somewhere between here and here, right? On the one hand, and on the other hand, what we've done as a discipline, as a, you know, as a science, in terms of reconstructing this computationally. To illustrate the ways in which the processing is layered, indirect, selective, and in particular, and that's the focus of this lecture, to start the first step, the first three steps, if you will, in the decomposition of the overall story into layers of the sort that we've talked about a few times already. And following on from the first lecture last week, where I talked about the ways in which the system breaking sometimes gives us better insight into how it's structured than the system in normal operation. We'll look at both optical illusions and neurological damage as insight, as providing insight into the way things work. And finally, by the end of the week, we'll look at one classic paper about a particular property of the optic system. What makes the neurons in the optical processing happy, and what the frog's eye in particular can and can't tell the frog's brain about what it's seeing. Well, the first distinction we're going to make is a distinction between what we'll call vision on the one hand and visual processing on the other, or visual perception, visual processing. Visual perception is what you experience of vision as a whole. It's your experience of seeing. And it's only a very small part of the overall phenomenon. The perception reflects things that are in the world. You, in the first instance, see, at least I'm seeing, you know, chairs and tables and shirts and pens and lights. I'm not seeing slightly not quite flat region of white with a little region of pale pink just below it and then a white stripe. Stop moving. I can't talk about your shirt. Okay, that's not what's going on, right? I'm seeing his shirt, not the constituent parts of the shirt, which, as we'll demonstrate over the next few days, are part of my visual system. They're involved with the vision, but they're not part of my perception. And furthermore, it's also not passive in the way that a camera is. That visual perception sees what it expects to see. It uses all the different inputs that it's getting to confirm its hypotheses. In particular, remember what I said about the fact that you don't actually see most of what you think you see most of the time. You're remembering having seen it a while ago and depending on very minimal cues to reassure yourself that it hasn't changed. So when I look over here, I know that that pillar is a particularly questionable shade of pale green. And when I look over here, I can still see that green pillar over there, despite the fact that the signal that's coming from that pillar is impinging on parts of my retina which don't have color sensors. So my belief that I'm seeing a green pillar is actually synthetic. And furthermore, and let's see, where's a good example from where you're sitting? So from where you're sitting, actually, bad example. Where's a good example? Okay, for most of you, you can see this pillar either from this side or from this side. And it's a silver pillar, right? Well, visually, of course, if you try hard, you'll realize it doesn't look silver exclusively. This surface is a lot brighter than this surface. Right? This is a light gray, and this is a dark gray from where you're sitting. Right? But you know, in inverted commas, that this is a single colored pillar. Interestingly enough, I'll bet, given the same phenomenon, it looks like this is a single colored pillar. But in fact, this side actually is darker than that side. Right? I'm right here, and I can tell you that this has got a little color in it, and this is pretty much white. Color constancy is the name for that phenomenon. If you're a painter, a portrait painter, an artist, as opposed to somebody who paints walls, you have to know about this. Because if you want to paint a picture of this room that looks like this room, you have to paint this surface with a lighter colored paint than you paint this surface so that it looks all the same color. It's very weird, isn't it? Right? So it's your knowledge of the world, your expectation that by and large, construction stuff looks, construction stuff is all the same color. And things that are painted green on the side of the wall look pretty much green, are green. They're not carefully painted dark green on one side and light green on the other side. Conscious expectations, all the way up to when you recognize somebody, you stop paying attention. You know that you've recognized them, and you don't need to see the details to know the details, because you already know them. So back to making sense, right? The visual areas of the brain are working actively to make sense of the world via this particular medium of interaction. Starting from the lowest level, light intensities in different wavelength bands as stimulating as the various bits of the optic retina are stimulated, right up to saying, oh yes, that's a chair and that's a computer screen and not vice versa. By the way, what do I mean by, why am I differentiating, recognizing, and categorizing? Well, it's one thing to say, these are, there are 30 or 40 people in this room. I recognize, I categorize the visual inputs that I'm getting from various parts of my visual field here as people. And on the other hand, I recognize Alyssa, right? That's not categorizing. That's actually identifying specifically. That's not going to be an important difference going forward, but it occurred to me that I should mention it here. So there's some kind of framework of processing where we're contributing to our representation of things in the outside world, and we're not reproducing them. We're transforming, or we're coupling with the outside world via this medium to give us representations which connect up with things in the real world. Well, These are terms of art: representation, reference, description. And different people use them in slightly different ways. And at least this week, we're going to try to use them the way David Marr used them. David Marr was a vision scientist at MIT in the 60s and 70s who died, unfortunately, young of leukemia. But before he did, he wrote a book which has had a huge impact on the study of vision in particular and cognitive science in general. And it was published after his death, and it's called Vision. And the first bit of required reading for this week is from that book. It's the sort of introductory sections, and it's linked from the homepage, which I'll get onto before we finish. For him, the notion of a representation is fundamental, but he has a slightly idiosyncratic definition of it. A representation is a constituent part of a cognitive model, of a multi-part model. And it's composed, on the one hand, of some formal system. Some, we can think of it as, without losing too much generality, some language of expressions defined in terms of some primitive symbols, and a grammar of how to build up more complex expressions from symbols and smaller, simpler expressions. So, not surprisingly, because this is a very general purpose definition, you can think about what we did last week in exactly these terms. We have a few simple symbols: N, V, hold, held, and lines, you know, little vertical and diagonal lines. And we have a little collection of principles that tell us how to construct bigger collections, bigger drawings out of smaller drawings, which we've talked about. That's some kind of formal system. It's half of a representation. Because the other half of the representation is a set of rules which connect up those expressions to the world, to the thing we're trying to understand, to model, to have a story about. And we didn't talk about that last week. If we had, we would have had to talk about the ways in which English spelling corresponds to the sounds of English. But we didn't do that. When we think of, there are lots of formal systems which don't mean anything, right? I could define a formal system, a bunch of rules for connecting up a bunch of symbols to build expressions, and all I've got is what the logicians would call, well, half of a logic. I've got some formal system. It's not a representation until it's about something. And it's not the kind of representation we care about until that aboutness is made explicit by some rules which we can interpret to connect up our formal system with the phenomenon that we're studying. And so in Marr's terms, and this is now a long way away from the ordinary language use of the word, a description is exactly that. It's a pairing in an explicit and rule-governed way of a representation, a formal system with structures like that, and things in the world using those rules. So let's look at an example. It's perhaps a little too simple, but it'll help get us started. We've got two things that we know that we use in the ordinary course of events to do with mathematics, right? And maybe you haven't thought about this very much, but this won't take very long. On the one hand, if we're speaking carefully, we have numerals, things that we can write on blackboards. All right, so that's a numeral. And it corresponds to the number 5. Oops, sorry, I forgot to write base 3. No, it doesn't correspond to number 5 in any base, does it? Nice try, Henry. Right? Base 3, it corresponds to the number 7. But it's a numeral, right? It's just a bunch of marks. The number is something else. Right? The number 7 is the successor of 6 and the predecessor of 8. Right? It's the number of people in the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, first little corner of the room here. Right? It's the number of days in the week. It's not this. That's just the numeral which we use to represent it. There is an important distinction. We can have lots of these. The number 7 is what it is. It's unique. It's individual. Okay? So we can see this pairing of something out there, admittedly somewhat abstract rather than concrete, the numbers, and something in the space of expressions, namely the numerals and systems of numerals, as an example of Mars' story. So, for instance, well, we'll shift now. I thought I'd change this. I changed it everywhere else, right? Decimal and binary numerals are a very simple kinds of expressions. They're just any concatenation of the 10 for decimal, 2 for binary digits. We call them, in decimal numeration, binary bits, we call them, right? Any concatenation of those numerals is itself a numeral. Right? Some of those are a little defective in the sense that we don't make a distinction between the number represented by that numeral and that one. So if you wanted to be a little more careful, you could write a little bit more specific rules that said it's the concatenation of any of the digits, as many as you want, but no zeros on the left. And then you get uniqueness as well as everything else. Right? So we've got this notion of expressions built up from simpler expressions. The concatenation of any two numerals is itself a numeral. Right? The story for Roman numerals is more complicated. There's a bigger set of initial symbols, and the rules for putting them together are more complex. But it's straight, you know, you can do it. It's been done many times. So that's the expression part, primary primitive symbols, method of combination to get more. Right? And now the rules, well, how do we relate things like this to the numbers? Well, it's sort of a compositional story just like the other one. We relate the primitives to the numbers a bit like our dictionary, right? We need the dictionary to tell us that this is the numeral for 7, and this is the numeral for 2, and this is the numeral for 1, and this is the numeral for 3. But for decimal, there are only 10 of those things that we have to say. And then we have the standard rule for composing a numeral for a number by dividing by powers of 10, if we're doing decimals, or for interpreting a numeral as a number by multiplying by powers of 10, starting from the right, so on and so forth, right? So these rules relate the space of numbers to the space of expressions of complex numerals. All a very trivial example. It's going to be a big jump to the kinds of things we're doing with vision, but it gives you something to go back to and say, gee, I didn't understand that. Let me go back and try again. Come back to this slide and look at it, and maybe that will help. So, for instance, here's a sort of illustration of the way in which the number, which I'm referring to with its English name, but I mean the number, right, 21, is related by rule to the numeral 2-1 in the decimal system, because we can multiply 2 times 10 to the first and add it to 1 times 10 to the naught and get 21, where all the things I said a minute ago were all about numbers, So where do we get to when we try to apply this to a story about vision? Well, our visual primitives are going to be a collection of symbols which are tied very closely to the very lowest levels of perception, to what we can get by almost complete, you know, almost entirely accessible via microscopic investigation of the retina, right? Patterns of light, dark, color, and so on. And we're going to try, and it's going to take several steps, to relate those by rule to the things in the world which we're seeing. And there's a lot of evidence, and we're going to spend the rest of the time looking at this, this time today, that you can't do this in one go, right? We get from numerals to numbers more or less directly. We don't need any intermediate steps. But just as the layers that we looked at in the first lecture last week suggest that to get from the computer in the Royal Bank of Scotland to my bank balance, we can't do that in one go either. Right? We did it in 7 or 8 levels. I don't remember how many, depending on how far down we wanted to go. Right? We're going to do something similar for vision. So we combine and ramify and enrich as we go up the levels, or we decompose and decompose and decompose as we go down the levels. But in this case, all the way up to our conscious understanding and recognition of a scene. So it helps to sort of act as a sort of sanity check on the models we propose to keep in mind what vision is for, if you will. So here's a definition from Marr again. Vision is a process that produces from images of the external world a description, technical term from Marr, remember, that is useful to the viewer and not cluttered with irrelevant information. So that bit about color constancy, that's one of the things where he's talking, that's an example of what he means, not cluttered with irrelevant information. Your representation, the description that you have of the visual scene in front of you, doesn't waste time, energy, mental space keeping track of the way in which the rounded corners here and the different angles of the faces of this pillar cause the actual frequency of the light impinging on your retina to differ. For you, it's a gray pillar. That's the kind of thing that's meant by not cluttered with irrelevant information. Useful to the viewer. Good enough to know that if I walk over here, I better not start going this way or I'm going to hurt my forehead. A useful bit of information. A useful bit of information that if I actually want to walk over and steal your pen, I have to take about 6 or 8 steps before I'm going to get there because it's fairly far away. Right? Whereas if I just wanted to pick up this bit of chalk off the desk, I can just reach my hand out and pick it up. So I know how far away things are. Right? How did I get that out of my visual system? Right? How do I know that this is, only an arm's length away, whereas if I wanted to pick that up, I have to walk over there? I mean, actually, the amount of the visual field that's subtended by this, the image of this little bit of chalk, if I hold it up at about arm's length, yeah, it's about right. It's just about exactly the same size as that gentleman's hand over there. But if I want to touch this, I can do it. If I want to touch that, it didn't quite make it. But I knew that. That's something hugely useful that I'm getting out of my visual system. How do I know that he's over there and this is over here? They're pretty much the same shape even, about pentagonal as it happens, given the way his hand is folded. About the same size. What's going on? Well, there are properties of the stereo aspects of the visual system. The fact that I've got two eyes that allows me to detect relative distance because of the relative separation of the two images. Got an image here, I've got an image here. In those images, the hand is not in the same place, quote unquote. Neither is the bit of chalk, but it's much closer to being in the same place because this is closer to me. That's the kind of useful information that Marr and his colleague Poggio spent their entire career trying to figure out. Right? How do we use the stereopsis of our visual system to give us that useful information of how far away things are? There are other ways. There are other inputs into that process. You know, I know, other things being equal, that hands are rather bigger than pieces of chalk. And so the fact that the piece of chalk and the hand appear to be the same size suggests the hand must be much further away. That's a little bit of higher level processing that feeds in or confirms the stereopsis derived information. So layers, utility, clutter, all of these things, useful concepts packaged in this very tight little definition. We're going to make the standard cognitive science assumption, which is there's a computational process going on, and we're going to use that process to construct these Marian descriptions, these mappings from expressions to the world. We're going to do that actively. And as we said on the previous slide, the lowest level of representation, and one which we can describe statically, or nearly so, without a process, is the sensitivity of the rods and cones in the retina to lights, to light of particular frequencies. And so we can start our story by a static coupling of light intensity to activation levels in the neurons connected to the rods and cones of the retina. But it's a long way from there to the representation that's well suited to the purpose for which it's used, this connected up with the thing up above. And that's going to vary. That's another thing we have to deal with. The fact is that what's useful for one organism or one purpose may not be useful for another organism or another purpose. And so the closest we have to, this is a sort of slightly hypothetical, but grounded in some pretty careful research, that if you want to think about what the snake sees as opposed to what we see, the snake sees largely in the infrared. The snake is looking for warm bodies because warm bodies are edible. And they're interesting. And nothing else really is, as far as the snake is concerned. So it sees a very different world than we see because that different world works for it. It does what it needs to get on in the world as a snake. And that's very different from what we see, what we need to get on in the world as human beings. And as I said, the particular thing that we'll focus on as an illustration of this by the end of the week is what is useful, what is the visual system of a frog producing that solves problems for the frog? And in particular, same problem. Frog has the same problem the snake has, more above anything else, the problem we're going to focus on, which is, where are those flies? Right? The flies that I need to eat to stay alive. Right? That's what the frog's looking for. So, a couple of slides ago, I put a fair amount of effort into trying to distinguish between vision, a fairly broad, layered, articulated phenomenon, from visual perception, our experience of the world as mediated through the visual medium. Can you have one without the other? If it's only our conscious experience of vision, what else is there? The implication is there must be some other bits of the visual processing that we're not aware of. And now we'll look very briefly at the first example of the thing I've talked about a few times, which is that neurological damage and the resulting deficits can give evidence that this is indeed the case. So, a famous patient in the cognitive literature, particular visual literature, is a patient whose initials were DF, sometimes referred to as D, nothing to do with the wire. Patient DF had extremely severe visual agnosia, technical term there. She had carbon monoxide poisoning in her early 30s, which did severe damage to parts of her optic cortex, frontal lobes. Her vision had been perfectly ordinary up until that time, and her eyes were not damaged. Neither was her optic nerve. Her pattern of deficits gives us some remarkable insight into the structuring of the visual system. Parenthesis. Agnosia is a term actually coined by Freud, based on ancient Greek, meaning without, and gnosis meaning knowledge. So agnosia means without knowledge. Visual agnosia is a loss of vision, loss of visual knowledge. You compare that with aphasia, which means without speech. There are lots of different kinds of visual agnosias, all of which in some way impair or are reflected by impairments in people's ability to recognize or process what they're seeing. Others that you may have encountered, I have a friend with prosopagnosia. There's actually a member of staff in the informatics school who has prosopagnosia. Inability to recognize faces. When you walk up to my friend, John, he doesn't know who you are until you speak, because he doesn't recognize people by their faces. The face is just, it's this difference between categorization. He knows it's a person and not a kangaroo, right? But he doesn't know it's Henry and not Alyssa until I start speaking, and then he recognizes my voice and he knows it's Henry. For us, it's extraordinarily difficult to get our heads around what that must be like. How could these, there are 40 or 50 of you, you're all different. Right? Well, for John, you're all different, but not in any way that connects up with anything. It's very hard to imagine what that could be like. But it's, he's been that way all his life. It's just normal life for him. There's just a little bit of his visual processing that just doesn't happen. The rest of these, the others of these are more serious. No motion perception. When things move, it's a surprise. You sort of see something move and, what's it doing over there? Even though you've seen it move, you still don't understand how it got there. You've lost the sort of connection between whatever visual flow there was and the fact that you were there and you're over there now. I can't imagine that one either. This one's in some ways a little easier somehow to imagine. You can only recognize, people with this agnosia can only recognize one object at a time, right? So they're looking at that, they can say, that's a mouse, but I don't know what it's sitting on. Or that's a screen, but I don't know what's sitting on it. Maybe that's, you can almost see how that might be something that could happen to you. Anyway, okay, so agnosias, right? Well, what about DF? What were her symptoms? What could she do and what couldn't she do? Well, what she couldn't do was actually identify shapes. She couldn't say, looking at it, that's a mouse, or that's a rectangle or a screen. Couldn't tell you what shapes things were presenting as. She couldn't even say, there's a boundary, there's an edge. Or if you drew a line on the whiteboard, she knew that the visual field had changed. She could say, you drew something on the board. Right? Well, I don't know about on the board, but you drew something. But And she knew what horizontal and vertical meant because she was perfectly good at vision up until she had this accident. But she could not tell you whether that line was vertical or horizontal. Hard to credit, but you have to accept this as fact. No figure-ground separation. That is, she couldn't distinguish an object from the background. And it follows that she was likely to identify different colored parts of an object as separate objects. So he said, how many things are there, you know, how many things are on the table? She would say four if there was something on the table which had three colored regions, maybe. But she could consciously name colors, say that's, you know, there's something red. Nope, now you've changed, it's blue. Right? So she could do, she got colors all right. And she could see textures, that is, she could tell that something was smooth or something was rough, something was plastic or something was metal, shiny, dull, things like that. So she didn't have the kind of very serious agnosia, which is called cortical blindness, where you, to all intents and purposes, you're blind despite the fact that your retina and your optic nerve are working. Right? Something further back isn't working, but you're effectively blind. You bump into things, you don't know what's going on in your visual field at all. More severe, but also, alas, more common. And the other thing was that what was really sort of odd was that despite these very serious problems, there were things she could do that she couldn't be conscious of doing, right? So for instance, if you put her in a room full of a bunch of stuff, she could walk from one side to the other and not bump into anything. So she was doing figure ground discrimination. She didn't think that that statue in front of her was actually something on the far wall. She could see it and walk around it. And even more amazingly, given that she couldn't tell you whether something was horizontal or vertical, she could reach out and grab a pencil regardless of which way you held it up to her. So if you held the pencil up like this, she would put her hand out like this and grab it. If you held the pencil out like this, she'd put her hand up like that and grab it. So she could do orientation, she just couldn't experience it consciously. Quite bizarre, right? And of course, she could grab it even though she couldn't tell you it was a pencil. Right? Until she got her hands on it, at which point she'd probably be able to figure it out. We'll go one step further to introduce a bit of terminology. There are also patients with the opposite kind of phenomena, opposite kind of deficits. They're fully conscious. They can say, that's a pencil and it's horizontal, but they can't reach out and grab it. They'll bump into it and they'll move their hand around until it happens to fit right and then they'll pick it up. So they can see, but they can't do. No problems with object shape identification and so on, but visually guided action doesn't happen. Right? It's random until you get into the touch space, and even then. Right? So this is almost the opposite of DF's problem. And this is what, in the neurological literature, is called a double dissociation. We have evidence in both ways, and we're nearly done. Right? We have evidence that the motor system's connection to visual processing and the conscious connection to visual processing are dissociated, because we've got people who've got one and not the other, and people who've got the other and not the one. That's very strong evidence that we've got to account for these in different ways in our modeling of the whole visual system. They're separate, at least in the brain, and therefore probably in our computational models. So to finish off, that's sort of a particular example of the kind that motivated David Marr to start from a sort of methodological stance, which said, when we look at models of cognitive phenomena in general, and a vision in particular, we're going to expect always to start with three levels of analysis. We're going to distinguish between the abstract nature of the problem, what it is we're trying to do, on the one hand. On the second, the algorithm that solves it, how we actually get the answer from the inputs. And finally, the way in which that algorithm is physically instantiated. As we hinted in the first lecture, when we looked at what amounts to an example of this, iterated many times, two accounts of the same phenomenon can differ at the algorithm level. So the problem is the problem, right? You can use two different algorithms to solve it. Trivial example from computing, which some of you may or may not know. If the problem is to convert a list of numbers into a sorted list of numbers, there are more algorithms than I've had hot dinners for doing that. And they're very different one from another. They have different properties. They have different complexities. You do them in different ways. But all of them do the same thing. They take an unsorted list and produce a sorted list. Different algorithms for achieving the same result. Or, given the algorithm, you can realize it in different substrates. We talked about that in the first lecture at a very high level, saying my web browser might be written in it, which has got an algorithmic description of how it's going to map from HTML markup to display primitives. But it could implement that mapping either in Python or in Java or in C Sharp or who knows, right? At the lowest level, or nearly at the lowest level, we've got a bunch of assembler language that we want to run on this hardware. Well, the hardware might be an Intel chip or it might be an AMD chip, in which case, at the level of the silicon, they're profoundly different, right? Completely different realizations of the same instruction set. Right? And we can distinguish AI from cognitive science with this vocabulary, because cognitive science's goal is to build a computational model which differs from the real thing only at the realization level. We use silicon, human beings use neurons. Whereas, in other words, we want to find the algorithms and differ only at the level of realization, of implementation. Whereas AI's goal is simply to solve the problem. We don't care if we use a different algorithm as long as we solve the same problem. It's solely the realization level. It doesn't care whether the difference is just at the realization level or at the algorithm level as well. Got time to show these slides, right? This is just to draw this out a little further and give an example. The problem here is we want to explain cash registers, right? What's a cash register doing? Well, in order to do that, we start with the algorithmic. What is it? We start with the problem description, the computational theory. What is it that a cash register is doing? Well, it's adding and subtracting, by and large. So we need a definition of addition and subtraction, a nice abstract definition of what it means to be the sum of a column of numbers, to be the difference between two numbers, and so on. That theory